Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is Monday, July 28, 2003. Today's session is entitled, An Army Without Weapons, Politics and Public Policy, presented by John Marty. Let's listen in.
Thank you for coming today. The topic today is, I think it was titled, An Army Without Weapons. It's an attempt to look at, there's a new group, Nonviolent Peace Force, which is trying to do on a larger scale what other groups such as Witness for Peace and other Christian peacekeeping teams and other type of organizations have tried in the past on a much broader scale. And I'm John Marty. I'm actually not a, I don't deal with national politics in my job. I'm a state legislator from Minnesota. But been very interested in this and followed it for a long time. I think many people at Holden have spent a lot of time wrestling with issues of pacifism versus just war theory and so on. Lay the framework of why we have to be concerned about this. In the 20th century, there were well over 100 million people around the world killed in wars. With increasing technology, increasing ability to kill a larger and larger number of people. And if the enter the new century, we face increasingly well-armed forces from national governments to individual citizens, guerrilla groups, whatever, and all of them are equipped or have the ability to get equipped with weapons far in advance of what people could have envisioned a year ago in killing effectiveness. It's not hard now for a small group to get a surface-to-air missile that can shoot down a passenger airplane. And certainly, many of these groups and nations have ability to acquire chemical, biological, nuclear, we're now calling weapons of mass destruction. Apparently, they're able to hide them very well because our administration and the British government knows Iraq had them and they still have them. But there is capability for your governments and individual groups to get very deadly killing devices. And despite our best efforts and the opportunities we have to get to know each other, I mean, they said in medieval times, the average person in Europe had a chance to know maybe 100 people in their lifetime. You will get to meet 100 people in their lifetime. You didn't travel anywhere. Well, here, one day you'll meet many times that, and in the course of a month you may meet thousands more than they'd meet in their entire lifetime. And now we have internet capabilities, mass media, so what happens in a battlefield in Iraq, everybody in the world can know about, depending on what sources of access they have. So we have ability to communicate better with each other, and therefore to break down misunderstandings. We have the ability to travel cheaper and easier than ever before. And I think there are many of us, many peoples in the world want to get along better, but despite that, I think people are just as filled with hate and misunderstanding and desire to harm other people as ever has existed. Our country is the leader in the military side of things, which is an argument why maybe we should be a leader in the nonviolent alternatives as well. I believe we are now spending far more than the top 6, 7, 10 other nations combined in terms of military spending. We're spending well over $1 billion a day right now just in the after war in Iraq. And the argument becomes, couldn't we as a nation, or we as a group of nations, or we as people do something to promote the alternatives? And for a quick background, I think most people, most American Christians are not pacifists. If we define pacifists as somebody who believes that war and violence is always wrong. I think many people, especially Christians, want to be pacifists. We'd like to do that, but we're not sure if it's realistic. We Lutherans look at Dietrich Bonhoeffer and see that even such a devout person of peace as him at some time feels there is evil so great that you need to turn to violence to prevent worse violence from happening. And most of us, as an alternative, I believe, pick a sense that realism requires us to believe in a just war theory. And ever since Augustine proposed it, it's been something that people have written and developed more and more about what's justified for war and when is it, when is it not. Politicians, everyone from George McGovern 30 years ago to George W. Bush these days, will say that they believe war is justified, is in certain cases they believe in a just war theory, or is maybe necessary as a last resort. And this session is not intended to make a case for or against pacifism, but to address the responsibility of those who believe in violence and war should be only a last resort. And the best example, best explanation I've heard of what means to be last resort, Ron Sider, the theologian who two or three decades ago had proposed this concept of Christian peacemaker teams, which there are a number of, I'll speak briefly about later. He asked how anyone in times when we've seen so many examples where nonviolent opposition or to unjust governments has been successful. The overthrow of Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines a couple decades ago, Mahatma Gandhi's overthrow of the British Empire, forces you, overwhelming forces that nobody had a chance to do, and yet they overturned it with nonviolence. Martin Luther King overturning segregation laws in the US. Well, Ron Sider says, how can Christians in the just war tradition claim the violence that they justify is truly a last resort until they've invested billions and trained tens of thousands of people in a powerful, sustained testing of the possibilities of nonviolent alternatives? He's suggesting before we say we need to throw our $1 billion a day at some other country, some other military, some bad folks, he's saying no matter how evil, how bad they are, can we say it's the last resort if we haven't put in some sort of significant resources into the alternative? And the obvious response is we haven't even tried. We have war colleges in which we train military leaders, we study and do research in military strategy. We don't even do these types of studies and research in nonviolence. I mean, there certainly are some minor centers for nonviolent studies, but no organized international effort to promote this, or no nation that does it as a national goal to work in this alternative. And as part of that, I mean, when we talk about pacifism or nonviolence, there's a big difference between pacifism and passivism. Nonviolence is not for passive people. It requires an action or a confrontation. And as Christians, if we look at Christ's ministry, everybody knows, well, maybe not everybody, but I think it's pretty clear in the gospel about how his life was dedicated to nonviolence, even when confronted with clearly dangerous threats against his life. He tells Peter to put away his sword. It was a continual and constant and ubiquitous theme about his commitment to nonviolence. But nobody was concerned that Christ was passive. He was confrontational, sometimes intentionally, maybe always intentionally confrontational. When he came across the money changers in the temple, that wasn't something that was a strange thing to him. He knew it existed. He went in there for the purpose of overturning their tables and chasing them out. That's not a passive person. That's somebody who's willing to confront injustice. And it's not to say that Christ was trying to pick a fight everywhere he could go. There were times when people were out to kill him, push him off a cliff, and he escaped from them. I mean, several times in Scripture you can read about how he used prudence and decided this was not the time or the place, and he slipped away. But he was very much in the mode of, we're going to stand up to injustice. And likewise, you will see many times now nonviolence activists, people who do stand up to things. I think the picture I'll remember from the rest of my lifetime is the individual standing up to the tank at Tiananmen Square and getting crushed by a feudal appearing type of situation, though it's not always feudal. When the Soviet government was collapsing, I think it was their Duma, their House of Parliament, where the reformers, the new people were taking over, and the Soviet army was confronting with tanks, and people just swarmed them, and they stood back. And same thing in the Philippines. in the 1980s. The Archbishop of Manila is speaking out and telling people to flood the streets and defend, which they said one of the few times where the civilians were defending the military because two of the military leaders had defected and said they were not going to support Marcos anymore. And here they had millions of citizens protecting the military from the other military. It has worked, it has done it, but it takes confrontation and sometimes extreme courage to do so. We ought not have unrealistic expectations of nonviolence. We act peacefully, and therefore they're going to be peaceful to us. I mean, the whole nature, the criticism of nonviolent alternatives is that, oh, they're so naive, these people are. They think if they just hold up a flag of peace and say, we love you, we'll be kind to you, that people will be kind to them. Well, that's never been the case. And when Gandhi spent several decades overthrowing British rule, they were many, tens of thousands of Indian citizens were killed. Innocent people were killed brutally. William James, in his essay, The Moral Equivalent of War, had a nice quote about this. This is a century ago, telling people, making a case for alternatives. He said, the war against war is going to be no holiday. He was saying that people will die in the process. And he described it, and I never thought about it this way, but he said war brings out in people, in individuals, some of the most noble traits that we think of. Loyalty, self-sacrifice, even sacrifice to the point of giving your life for your country or your life for whatever you're fighting for. Courage, discipline, dedication, all those good, noble traits in human beings come out in war. And he argues, isn't it going to be necessary for alternatives to war to require just as much dedication, just as much loyalty, just as much commitment, just as much willingness to sacrifice even your own life? And he doesn't point out, but I think it's clear to point out that in saying this, that people will die despite trying to do the right thing, why should we do that? How can we stand up? We can fight them, and instead we're going to just sit there and let them kill us? How can we do it? Well, we accept tens of thousands, we accept millions of deaths in war. It's just the cost of war, it's just what you have to do. And I think James and others argue that the same thing is going to happen in nonviolent alternatives, and we have to expect that. That's the realistic reality. And Ron Sider, who I mentioned earlier, he suggests that, question obviously comes in, who's going to volunteer to give up their life without holding any weapon when somebody's shooting at them? Who's going to volunteer to do this? And he said, there's a risk of death in both warfare and in nonviolent alternatives, and it hasn't seemed to deter volunteers in either in the past, and so he makes the case that people will still come up. Well, where has it been done? I mean, first of all, Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi are the examples, the textbook examples everybody gives of nonviolence, a commitment to perhaps in both their cases, a faith-based nonviolence, to stand up to people with guns who are willing and able to kill them. There are plenty of examples in recent years. In the early 80s, a group called Witness for Peace in Nicaragua went down there, and they started this sort of being, by their very name, Witness for Peace, standing up in various places, sometimes getting between people with guns in the alternative, being willing to put themselves in the middle of it. Ron Sider had proposed 2 decades ago these Christian peacemaker teams, CPT. Mm-hmm. And we had the chance a couple years ago to visit one of the teams in Hebron and in Israel, Palestine, and just meeting some of the people there and the courage they had. The one guy who sort of was the leader of the team at the time told us how, yes, in the basement of this one synagogue there's a museum, because in the 1920s there was a Palestinian slaughter of Jews in Hebron. And of course, Hebron's also, I mean, it's been a flashpoint in the 1990s. There was that Jewish physician who went into mosque and slaughtered 50, 60 people while they were praying. It's that kind of a climate. Well, this head of the CPT team said that, I asked him if he had ever been in this basement of the synagogue in this museum. And he said, no, he'd like to, but he thinks that some of the Jewish soldiers and the Jewish people there would see it as, he's on the other side. We don't want him in here. He's not good enough. He doesn't care about us or our suffering. He only cares about the other side. And he said that they early on experienced, or he had seen, I guess, I don't know if it was one of their team members, that some soldiers were sort of arguing with them, and one of the people was trying to empathize with them and saying, I know what you're going through. I lost a grandmother or something in the Holocaust. And their response was a sneering, you lost one person, some of us lost whole families, which is a legitimate expected response. But the point is they're trying to get there in both sides. If the Palestinian people are attacking, they try and get in front of that. They try and get in front of, they are some who, a group that's been in front of the Palestinian homes that are being destroyed by Jewish settlements, or for whatever reason, they get in front of the bulldozers. And it wasn't a CPT member, but it was another similar peace group where made national news here, where a young college student last spring was bulldozed down. The bulldozer driver didn't see her, though she had a bullhorn there, and was begging him to stop bulldozing and crushed her. There are people who die in this, looking at the CPT team and hearing the stories of them going along with Palestinians through dangerous checkpoints where they have to pass to get to the hospital even, they couldn't get there. There are plenty of examples of the need for them there. While they are a small group, the CPT teams are, I think, 8 or 10 people, you see the need for it. The hospital that the offering last night was going to, Augusta Victoria Hospital in Jerusalem, is a Palestinian, a Lutheran Palestinian hospital. And to get there, you have to often go through many checkpoints, and they've often been frustrated. They send ambulances out, and they can't get to the people who need emergency treatment. They can't bring them back. So with that kind of checkpoints that are that rigid, a group that's going to stand there and be with them from an international presence can be a real power. There's new international group, the Nonviolent Peace Force. It was founded by a couple of people, one of whom I know from Minnesota, who's been active in a number of things from self-advocacy movement for people with disabilities a couple of decades ago to one project after another he often takes on what people would call losing causes. Works very hard for, he met another peace activist in England a number of years ago, and they, over several years, decided to form a nonviolent peace force. And they're trying to do what Christian peacemaking teams and Witness for Peace and many other such groups are doing on a broader level. They're trying to do the research that doesn't get done. They had a year or two long feasibility study which they contracted with a number of experts to study the whole situation about how this might work and what might be possible. And their goal is to have an active force of 200 professional peacekeepers this year and 400 reserve members. And then they spent a year reviewing, I think they looked at Guatemala, they looked at Sri Lanka, and they looked at Israel-Palestinian fights. And they picked, last year at their convention in New Delhi, they picked Sri Lanka as their first pilot project. And their goal is to grow. Their goal is to have 10 times as many members by 5-6 years from now, which requires, I keep asking how they're gonna do this, because so far they've been mainly small contributions from people, but their conventions, international conventions, I think they had delegates from 47 countries last time. And I clicked on their webpage a number of months ago and had a question about something and contacted their webpage person, and I mentioned my friend this. He said, oh yeah, our webpage person's in Australia. I thought it was somebody in Minnesota I was dealing with, but the internet makes it easy to deal with. But their research, they concluded you need three things in order to promote a nonviolent alternative. We need peacekeepers, people who will do what they're envisioning doing, stepping into a hot situation, and partly by being an international presence, partly through the things they do. They're trying to immediately stop killing and stop human rights violations so that the other two functions, peacemakers and peace builders, can occur at the same time. They describe the peace builders as the ones who build the infrastructure, the nonprofit organizations, the maybe sometimes the government. They're working to build social infrastructure, to build unity between groups. We had a friend who worked for Catholic Relief Services in Jerusalem, trying to, his function was not relief, his function was trying to bring Palestinians and Israelis together in a nonviolent manner. But the peacemakers, they see as the role of the politicians, the diplomats, sometimes an independent group that has so much credibility worldwide that they can step and intervene. Jesse Jackson in the 1990s, a couple of times, sometimes with the U.S. government cringing, stepped in going to Cuba or other countries trying to arrange for release of political prisoners. But the peacemakers are people who, they have to have somebody at a different level who will bring in and bring the peace. The same thing in Israel-Palestine right now, the diplomats, our governments, others are trying to bring about negotiations and peace, but it makes it much harder when people are shooting at each other and bombing each other, and therefore they're trying to see themselves as fitting in a role of trying to bring the immediate peace that enables the other two, the peacemakers and the peace builders, to work at the same time. And their theory of how this all should work would be that they train, first of all, they require a local invitation in Sri Lanka with several peace groups and other people working for peace that invite them. And they feel that those are the organizations that are going to have to be the peace builders. They're going to have to do those other functions. And that's why an outside group can't just come in and say, hey, we're here to help. They need the invitation from local people working for peace. And when I said they reviewed, they considered going into Guatemala and Sri Lanka and Israel-Palestine, they were all local proposals from those three countries. From, these aren't officially sanctioned governments asking for this, is groups who have been working for peace, whether they're religious or other nonprofit organizations, they are the ones who invite them in. And they believe they need an invitation in order to do that. They'd like to have sort of recognition from the sides of a conflict that they're there in sort of a, well, we don't mind if you're here, at least, though they acknowledge that that's not always possible and it still may be worth coming in despite that. And then they plan to train, and they have a general training on peacemaking, peacekeeping, general training, and then specific to the situation for their volunteers, which are their peace workers, which are not volunteers. They are going to give them months of training and then deploy, they hope in the first case, 200 peace workers in Sri Lanka. And their functions would be to protect human rights and prevent violence and to accomplish the broader goal of getting a peaceful resolution of the conflict, partly by, well, mainly by doing those other things and enabling other efforts to accomplish the other goals. And Sri Lanka, I read shortly, a month or two after I read that they had picked Sri Lanka for their pilot project, I read Sri Lanka, there was now some peace negotiations that had reached some sort of settlement of a first step. It was very tentative, and I asked, well, does this mean you're not going to be as much needed there? No, we're more needed now than ever. We see a real chance, real opportunity for peace. But with the bloodshed going on and continuing, we're needed more than ever now. We're not sufficient to resolve the problem. We're part of it. And what do they do in supporting a peaceful resolution? They see, I think they have four functions they see themselves doing, one of which called protective accompaniment. That's where you pick the leaders. Benigno Aquino in the Philippines in the 1980s, he had been Marcos's chief. He was a politician and Marcos's chief political opponent, which meant he spent a decade in prison. there's an advantage in American politics. You suffer defeat, you lose at the polls, and you go on with your life. Other countries, they shoot you or arrest you. We have it pretty good here. But people like, you know, he was in the United States in whatever year it was, 83, I think. He spoke to the U.S. Congress testified there about what was happening, what was going on, and he concluded his best role was to go back there and keep fighting through peaceful means for democracy, and knowing he was likely to be arrested. He was planning on being arrested when he got off the plane. They gunned him down instead. There are many times when groups, especially in Central America, have gone along with priests and nuns, many of whom have died in the process, have gone along with leaders. Peace activists, Nobel Prize winning authors, others who are trying to build peace, sometimes just having an American or other nationality presence there makes it politically difficult for people to just accidentally eliminate somebody. But the protective accompaniment is one function they plan to do. The general, I'm not sure, just the international presence, they try and do the same thing for communities. Witness for Peace has done this very effectively. They will go to a small village in the 1980s. They went to villages in Nicaragua where the Contras were coming in and 30 people being disappeared. And just having a presence of 10 or 15 Americans there will often be enough to stop them from doing it, because using the 1980s, the Contras were a U.S.-funded guerrilla faction, and they them killing American citizens was not necessarily looked too kindly upon by the national media and others. So just being an international presence could do the same thing they do for the leaders that way. Then they also try and publicize. One of the arguments, I mean, it doesn't do any good for one person to stand up to a tank in Tiananmen Square or in Moscow or anywhere if nobody sees it. It's just by witnessing it to the whole world through disseminating information that you can make the political cost of violence too great. I think in any time, nonviolence against machine guns and tanks, it can't possibly win if you're just talking about military force. It's by its definition not challenging that. It's challenging the other's willingness to do it. And in the Philippines, I think soldiers, some of the armored personnel carriers going up to attack the buildings that the defecting army leaders were in, and the people crowding behind them, they started moving forward on the crowd several times. People screaming and so on, and then the soldiers did, and I remember reading about one witness who said that looking at the expression on the soldier's face, he didn't want to go in there and kill armed, unarmed mothers, a woman in a wheelchair. They didn't want to go in there and do that. When the archbishop and all the bishops in the Philippines are telling people to flood the streets, when Aquino's widow is out there telling people flood the streets, the soldiers, you know, what do? We can't kill our own people. We're following orders, and they back off, and then they approach again, and they back off. And it's appealing to that the witnessing for peace, both in the national media and among the hearts and minds of the followers of the oppressive government or force that you're trying to have an impact on. And then finally, the peace force's goal is to interposition themselves, put themselves between two armies, put themselves between individuals. I read some time ago, and I don't know if this is accurate, but the picture of that sculpture of Christ with arms outstretched, and I think it's Rio de Janeiro. I've seen the picture many times over the years, but never heard what it was there for, who put this sculpture on a mountain, massive sculpture. And I read somewhere, and can't vouch for its accuracy, but sometime in the 1800s, deteriorating relationships between Chile and Argentina had grown to the point of warfare, and the armies were marching towards each other, and two bishops from the two countries decided they could do something to intervene, and they went in front of the troops, and in front of all of them, met each other, gave each other a kiss of peace in front of their two armies, and signed some sort of agreement of wanting to work together, and single-handedly, so to speak, turned back the armies. And those things happened. That's what that sculpture, I'm told, was put in place for. I never remember reading that, but that's 100-some years ago. The interpositioning, those two bishops in largely Roman Catholic countries at the time would have a powerful presence, more than you or I as two individuals might be doing, coming there and giving a kiss of peace and saying, hey, let's be friends. But the whole concept is we put ourselves between the people, the two armies, or between the army and the people they are planning to kill or arrest or whatever they're planning to do with them. And to me, when I look at the Christian peacekeeping people we met in Hebron and folks like that in Colombia and others, that's the scariest part of the job, because the other side doesn't care about human life. They don't care about that. And, if they can get away with it, they'll do it. Witness for Peace learned later on from government documents and other things that were released that the Contra forces very clearly knew where Witness for Peace people were. And while they at one time kidnapped them and arrested them, I guess they'd call it, and threatened to kill them all and treated them very poorly, it's certain that a day or two later they released them. Why? Because they were scared of them. They were scared of the power, of course, the power they brought. So anyhow, I want to open up for discussion in a second, but the in all of these cases, the whole point is these are small nonprofit organizations trying to bring about peace. And the quote I gave you earlier from Ron Sider saying, how can we, who believe in just war, meaning war only as a last resort, say we've gone to last resort when we haven't put as much resources into the peacekeeping and the peacemaking as we do into the violent protection? And does it change hearts? I mean, that's the whole issue. I mean, you can't face down a gun with words and expect to win except by changing people's hearts and minds. I think I've given several examples. I mean, the end of apartheid in South Africa, who would have thought that you could end that with nonviolence in Poland, the whole Soviet Empire collapsing. It was not by violent overthrow. I mean, despite the fact that we had nuclear weapons superiority over them, we could never use them. And it was shipyard workers in Poland standing up and saying, we're not gonna do this, and the Philippines, many other cases. But one of the things I learned in reading about Gandhi's work in overthrowing the Indian rule was there was a group of Muslim fighters in the area between Khyber Pass, between Afghanistan and India, Pakistan, brutal fighting force that the British Army said they were the most savage fighters they had ever encountered. And the individual who apparently listened to and believed in and followed Gandhi, who was a leader of this force, became hooked on the idea, and he sold it to his own people that we're not going to kill ourselves. We're not going to kill anymore. We're not going to, the most savage fighters, to the point that Gandhi said he was impressed. He was amazed that you could take the most savage of people and make them into nonviolent people. And you'd think, well, these are tough, nasty, cold-blooded, ruthless killers. Somebody tells them they're going to be nonviolent. Well, that'll last as long as somebody comes up and shoots one of them and so on. Well, the British troops actually tortured some of them. They threw them in pools of excrement after beating them. They shot them. They tried everything they could. And the soldiers didn't, these Muslim fighters did not fight back. And it was, I mean, to me, that was one of the most amazing parts. It was, we hear about Gandhi marching to the sea and getting salt illegally and other things like that. Well, some of his followers persuaded some of the most militant folks to join that. And so it does give you hope. It gives you a sense that it does work. As long as we don't have the expectation that, hey, we're gonna wave a flag and say we're for peace and everybody's gonna be peaceful to us. It requires the same kind of courage and conviction that it does for the people who are so driven to war. Anyhow, I think that I just wanted to throw this out as an example of, or try and frame a discussion of this, and we still have about half the time left to open it up for, I'm not sure which way the discussion will go on this, whether it's about what we should be doing, or what works well, or what doesn't work, or maybe some alternatives. Okay, yes?
When you mentioned Sri Lanka and this group went in and then they trained volunteers, are those volunteers out of the community there so that they're the native people to that area?
Right, okay, no, this nonviolent peace force, and they haven't begun their project in Sri Lanka yet. This is their slower moving in terms of, I mean, some of the other groups they've been doing this for a couple of decades, or I'm not sure the name of it, but a number of European peace communities where they have people like the CPT teams and others who are already out there, and there's a new crisis comes up in Chiapas, Mexico, they will send people there. This group has not begun in Sri Lanka, but no, they are very intentionally outsiders, an international force, partly because they believe it brings world attention and world condemnation to people who shoot at them. I mean, that may be not much to hang your hat on or your life on, but it's what you have. And so they bring in outside people, again, with the understanding in their case that they will not come without the invitation of local people, and they do not see themselves as the ones who can build the peace. They do not see themselves as the ones who can build the infrastructure or even negotiate the peace. They see themselves only as being able to, through their stepping in between, through staying with people, through accompanying political leaders, can stop violence and stop human rights abuses. So they see themselves as one part of the picture, but they see it as important that they be outsiders. And in the same way that I think lots of people before the Iraq War this year were hoping that the U.S. would not unilaterally do anything, there's a little more, even if the United Nations is bringing guns and so on into it, if it's a world sanctioned thing, there's a little more, if nothing else, it may make it more sense of, I mean, in Iraq you find out now, oh, we were able to bash their military to bits, and yet they keep somehow or another picking off somebody new every day, and are we any closer to peace than we were 6 months ago? I don't know that we are. The hope is if you have an international presence, that people will see, and especially in this case, a nonviolent international presence.
But isn't it important for the people, the native people, to work out the final deal?
That's their concept, that the native people, first of all, have to want, and it may not be a majority, well, I think in most war-torn countries, a majority of people do want peace. They do want to work things out, but it doesn't take many people to throw many bombs to make the whole situation blow up, and the Palestinian-Israeli situation is a perfect example. You have somebody bomb a bus, and then you gun down a bunch of other people, pull down more homes, and shoot people, kids throwing rocks. And you escalate the violence. Yes, the local people have to do the peace building, as they call it, and people at a different level, whether it's diplomats, politicians, whether it's people from other countries, Colin Powell going in, or people from Japanese political leadership going in, or anywhere else coming in and working with the local sides and trying to bring them to the negotiating table and bring peace. They don't see that as their role. They think that there's a very useful thing in having people who are committed to nonviolence be there to try and stop the killing in the meantime. Over here, then.
Two points. The first one, I recommend you on mentioning the statue. The name of the statue is Christ of the Andes. That's really good. And the second point, you mentioned Gandhi. Gandhi, for his principle, was Satyagraha. And in Hindi, that means true force. He was depicted like I was laying down in front of a window. And we cite Gandhi. But the whole thing, Gandhi was dependent on the morality, laughing rule of the English. You know, a lot of people were not laid down at a railroad. But the Indians were because the English were moral. And that's the end of the lecture.
And I think the English being moral, I mean, trying to define what's moral, who is moral. I mean, the British did brutal things.
Yes.
They had a conscience. The example I gave of that Muslim group of fighters in the Afghan border of India and Pakistan at the time was that those were people who you would see as most without a conscience. The British soldiers described them as the most savage, brutal people they had ever come across. And they were the ones who were so converted from teachings of nonviolence that they, even when they themselves, the same people, they picked a red shirt type of uniform, they were sold, they weren't going to kill people. And even when they were tortured themselves, they kept doing it. So I was going to say, saying the British, that Gandhi could rely on the fact that at a certain point you reach the breaking point of the British because they have a conscience, the point of raising that one Muslim fighter group that was described by the British and everyone is the most brutal. The fact that you could convert them suggests you may have a chance of converting people. And frankly, in the Philippines, Marcos never did step down. It was a fraudulent election, if you recall, that he had declared national elections and then, and instead of people saying we're going to boycott the elections, the opposition decided we're going to, one, organize and tell people you got to vote, you got to do this, we're going to watch the ballot boxes, we're going to try and bring in international observers, we're going to try all this. And even so, Aquino, who held all the cards, determined he had enough vote fraud to do this. And then when they're counting the votes so the their Congress could ratify his election, 30 of the ballot counters resigned, saying, you know, we can't stomach this wholesale voter fraud thing to prove this. Well, so Marcos still had the military with him. And they never did convert him, but Fidel Ramos and I can't think of the other guy who were his top military leaders, they at a certain point saw what was happening in the church and everybody speaking out against it. They cracked. And they said, we can't take this anymore. And they're the ones who started, who walked out with 200 people or so, and then the whole army's coming on after them when the public intervened. So you don't, you're not going to open the heart of every person, no matter how cruel and bloodthirsty and whatever else. You're not necessarily going to, no guarantees, but I think the thought is that you don't have to get everyone. At a certain point, things collapse around you. The
critical mass.
Go ahead, critical mass.
Critical mass.
That's a good term for it, yeah.
Well, that's a physical, I mean, that's science.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You get a physical, and you get it at one point and your kinetic energy is going to make
yeah.
it go.
And I'm not talking here about pacifists who believe never should you use violence. If I or we were in Dietrich Bonhoeffer's shoes, would we do the same thing? I think many people would, or hope they would. Well, we'd probably never be in a situation because we don't have the courage to get that far. But this is not talking for the pacifist. This is talking about the person that all of our political leaders from, again, going back three decades to get George McGovern, one side would be seen as a peace activist, and George W. Bush, who others would see as anything but that, all of them saying just war theory is something we believe in. We believe in war only as a last resort. And I'm not saying in this that, I mean, nonviolent peace force may be pacifist. They may not believe there is any call ever to do so. I don't think you have to believe that pacifism will always, that nonviolent interaction will always work to suggest that if war is the last resort, you got to do all the other stuff first. Mm-hmm. And that's what we failed to do. So I don't know who had their hand up here. Well, I'll just pick over here then.
Thank you. I'm from Minnesota, and I'm a big fan of the nonviolent peace force. I happened to be fortunate to be at a meeting when they were having a big international meeting. And so I met some of the people who were involved, including, I think, a couple who were ready to go to Sri Lanka. I was very impressed. And one thing I think is important is that it wouldn't be just Americans. It would be a real international group that they're putting together. And of course, an important thing now is they're raising money, and they're selling peace bonds, I think, for $10 each.
Yes.
And you can, of course, buy one or as many as you
want
to buy.
And they are, the thing that struck me is the individual who I knew who had found this 3-4 years ago, I mean, it was kind of a big concept. I knew what peacekeeping groups, or nonviolent groups were doing and so on. And yes, lots of people, oh yeah, Ron Sider's vision for Christian peacemaking teams was going to be that they were going to keep growing in size. And usually the first thing you do is you channel that enthusiasm and get some eager young people to go and step out there and do it. And while it tends to be the peace churches, Mennonites and others who have been providing a lot of the volunteers for like CPT, this group starts out and does feasibility studies, I mean, boring stuff. And they send teams researching to various conflict situations and see where they may have an impact. But yeah, it truly is, when I mentioned the webpage Designers Australia, and so-and-so is here, and you contact people by internet, well, what country are you from? And it really is a massive international effort, they will need, they're looking for, so they're hoping they'll find some generous foundations or individuals who can do large contributions, because again, to have a paid force, a trained force of 2,000 people and 4,000 reserves 5 years from now, they need a lot of money to do it, but it's exciting.
John, the question I wanted to ask you is, you said if we're going to subscribe as a government, you as the United States, to a just war theory, then we should be doing our best to make sure it's a last resort and committing money to something like a peaceful solution. But a number of people have said, you yourself too, that it's good that such things at the moment are international organizations funded by individuals. In what way could our government provide funding that people would trust in the direction of peace? I mean, do you have any sense?
Yeah.
You talk to us
because if we put, if we fund a thing, oh boy, that's very suspect.
Yeah.
I mean, CIA's done all kinds of peaceful things that were designed to put our friends or people who shouldn't be our friends.
Nevertheless, if we've got no line item in our budget
right.
for peace
for
building
peace.
And peacemaking, how do we ever change the government?
Want to comment on that?
Yeah, Dennis Kucinich, who's a representative from Ohio, has introduced a bill to take 1% of our military budget, which would be quite a bit of money every year.
Yeah. More than enough to fund
to start a Department of Peace that would put most of their money into research about nonviolent nonviolent strategy, because they say that nonviolence right now is about where Edison. Like when Edison started experimenting with electricity, like we don't have any ideas of what it could bring to this world. And so to start researching that and playing around with it, and then to eventually have that be a part of our national security system.
Yeah. I mean, it used to be called the Department of War, and then we decided that didn't sound very good, so we changed it to Department of Defense. Though when it becomes a little more offensive, it's... you question about whether it's that's an appropriate name, but I do think that our government could, well, the United Nations is not a sham. It's not, I mean, the same way the League of Nations was a sham. It ducked anything. It took no intervention. It was a truly passive group, not a pacifist, but passive group. The United Nations has moved forward in this way, and sometimes they have had truly useful peacekeeping roles, though they're different from like nonviolent peace forces. They're armed, but you know, when they were going into certain Balkan areas and so on, peacekeeping, they were not armed as heavily as the people. Talking to the UN guy, reading about, I didn't talk to him personally, reading interviews with the UN guy in Rwanda during the slaughters there, was begging for more UN troops to come in. He's saying, we can't do it with this number. He wasn't asking for heavier arms, but just so more bodies could be there to stop 500,000 people being slaughtered. I mean, he talks about this is a retired guy, I think he's from Canada, talking about what he goes through every night, thinking of what happened a decade ago while he was there. The UN can and has, in this very limited way, done some things, and if we funded them so that they could intervene more in a case like that, again, they're not truly nonviolent in the sense that they have, they are carrying weapons, but I think that it's a, it is a peacekeeping function that international governments could do, and our country is usually among the most reluctant to fund the United Nations,
yes.
But I think the whole concept of putting a line item in our budget, even 1% of the Defense Department budget, I mean, that's a few billion dollars a year to, which would more than generously, I think the Nonviolent Peace Forces are hoping for several $1 million a year budget, not several $1 billion budget. So lots of points. I'm not sure. I'm trying to go in a fair order, but go ahead.
We do that. We have more than 1% of our defense budget funding the United Nations, and as you said, that's the peacekeeping body.
You
can't overlook that.
Yeah, but the United Nations is, I mean, it's got lots of good things that are happening. A lot of them are not peacekeeping, and I think that.
I understand, but I'm saying we can't overlook that.
Right, okay, that we're doing some there and that the UN has a powerful, yes, has a powerful role and could have a more powerful one. Frankly, if we provide the leadership, I mean, whenever the disputes about should we be selling arms for profit to other countries, we're the number one arms exporter. If we say, oh, we want with the French and Chinese and everybody else will be selling these highly sophisticated things, well, I remember reading one clipping, it was about in whichever paper, Minneapolis paper, New York Times, whatever, and a clipping this big when Clinton announced fairly late, I think it was in his second term, he announced that they were gonna stop what had been sort of an informal US prohibition on selling arms to Latin American countries, to South American countries. We hadn't been selling them for a number of years, apparently. And just, well, you know, things are okay there, we can sell them. And well, we sell, I mean, we're really good at selling weapons to both sides of things. Mm-hmm. If we use our moral leadership and say, we're not gonna sell. Doesn't mean the French or the Chinese or, yeah, opponents of ours in many ways can't sell and can't make the profit that our businesses could make. But we're the number one seller. And the same thing in the UN. If we are gonna put our commitments to the UN, and we're gonna say we want them to intervene in places like this, people have been saying, if we felt so necessary to strike a preemptive war against Iraq, couldn't we at least do something in Liberia and some other places? Well, maybe we could be working with the UN more aggressively in doing this. Paul?
I was going to say, you know, it's occurred to me that our State Department should be our Department of Peace, that we already have that in place. And maybe what we need to do is get that to have a higher profile and more money in the State Department. We already have people in countries all over the world, Americans, highly trained Americans. But in contrast to the Defense Department, which has a recruiting station in every mall in America, you know, how are people recruited for the State Department? It's a little club, it seems to me. And I think it would be better to have more funding for the State Department and have the State Department bigger and more representative of all America and recruit for the State Department like we recruit for the military. And then we would, that's maybe a way to get going without having to establish another department and we could go with what we've already got.
And there is, I mean, the State Department has at many times done very good things about that, and you're right, you can serve that point, but I think the point over here about people trusting, I mean, certainly there's a lot of weariness about anything connected with the U.S. government, period, which you can't get rid of overnight. Jimmy Carter, two and a half decades ago, focused on international human rights. Only president in modern times to make human rights a commitment. You know, it takes time to build that, but our State Department, which does some good things, could also could in time build up a reputation of that, but we have to, as you said, prioritize it or something.
I was really struck by one thing you talked about, John. It's really, really key to the leadership. Even though we've got offices in all the malls in the United States, everything. I remember as 19 years old, and you know, I wanted to fly jet planes. But I didn't think about dying. I was not, I wasn't going to die. I was somebody else who might die. I was basically bulletproof. I was 19 and I was bulletproof. And but that is a commitment that gets made as soon as somebody says, I will go ahead and join the Army, the Navy, or whatever. I will go ahead and fight for this country. But also the commitment is there that I'm willing to die. I think in the peace movement we've been a little naive in realizing that commitment has got to be there just as strong, if not more strongly, because it's more difficult to die when you're naked than it is when you're armed to the teeth, I think, for most people. You feel somehow like when you've got a flak jacket on and you're somehow more invulnerable to that. But I think that's really a key in all of this that really strikes me, and that was something that, in my limited experience during the Civil Rights Movement, that people without a flak jacket on were willing to lay themselves out and say, yeah, I might die today. And even trained to be able to die without raising their arms,
Even when they're getting beaten.
Beaten up. I had a personal experience. I knew somebody who went down, and he was a great big, about 6'3", 230-pound football player from Stanford. And he went down there, and he'd been trained to not respond. He said he thought he was gonna be dead. And the only reason that he thinks that didn't happen, but he didn't respond. He was committed enough to not respond. And that's somehow key. We don't ever think about that. What's one of the key issues? What's one of the key trainings if we're gonna have really a peace force or a peace mission? Is the ability for people to make that commitment safe. And you know, this goes way back into the Christian history. That you know, at what point are we able to lay what for all of us is pretty much the ultimate sacrifice, our own lives, on the line, and be very specifically upfront about that, and realize this is really where it is. This is what it's all about. This is the kind of confrontation that has to be made. No, I am willing to die without taking up arms and without taking up violence against you. And that's what I think you're talking about that happened in the Philippines, it's happened in the Civil Rights Movement, it's happened all over. And it's at some point in time, even though you're up against some, you know, heinous bunch of savages, at some point in time, there seems to come a
crack. Yeah.
People do crack.
They crack under torture, other things. People holding all the military might do crack too under humanity. When you gave the example of a Stanford football player going down the civil rights thing, tough guy willing to do this, being told he's got to be willing to not fight back. I was going to say, most of the people going down the civil rights movement were not the football player types, they were nuns and so on. I remember my dad went down for Selma, the second Selma march. And they went and they cowered in the back of the line, and the king walked up and said, okay, here we go, and it was the front of the line, they were all terrified. They were all trying to get in the back. But that's the way it works. You know, we don't want to do it. We do want to. I mean, it's a very nice thing to talk about here in the mountains in a retreat type of community, to be talking about the glory of the nobility of a peace movement, but yeah, as William James had suggested, yeah, it's no picnic. It's everything that you expect out of people in a war: the courage and the self-sacrifice and the risk. You need the same things here. And courage doesn't mean you're not scared; it just means you live with the fear.
By the way, I'll be posting flyers from Christian Peacemaker Team and Ecumenical Accompaniers, the World Council of Churches, which the ELCA is part of nationally and internationally, has developed a program that is modeled after the CPT teams, and Lutherans will go through the Lutheran governmental, well, I've got it on the brochure anyway.
But where are you going to put those?
I'm going to put it, there's a job board right next to that kind of middle back door that goes into the dining hall.
By the registrar's office?
Yeah. Yes, so it'll be on the outside there. I'll post them today. And then additionally, someone asked a question about whether or not with the nonviolence, whether maybe local communities have invited them in. And in the case of the organization that Rachel Corey, the young college girl that was bulldozed, that's the International Solidarity Movement. Very much, you know, by invitation, it's Palestinian nonviolence with actually working with Israeli justice organizations too. And when you said that there were the soldier did not see Rachel Corey be bulldozed, that is the IDF's account, the Israeli military's account as to that, but all the ISM volunteers who were there and photographing at the time and all of their statements make it very clear that, and I've seen the photos, she's in an orange flak jacket with a bullhorn standing on the mound. So there's a poster over there that says, If Americans Knew. I'm not sure if they have, I haven't actually gone to that website, but I do receive accounts from ISM, and they're really truly do what you say about putting interpositioning themselves. CPTs do that a little less so, but also that, and boy, when we were in Hebron, I felt like we were with Holden Ice when we were meeting with the CPT people, so.
Very
talk about move.com too.
No, I'm not going to, that's enough.
But it's good, and your point about how, you know, we often think, oh, they're coming in at the invitation of peace groups on one side, the Palestinian peace groups. Well, no, the Israeli peace groups are there too and inviting them in, and very much, there are people on both sides in most conflicts who are believers in alternatives to what's happening, and very many of them. We have to wrap it up in about 3 minutes. Other things, I'm not sure if you're calling it too many hands. So you then.
I'm really concerned about the image of America abroad. I mean, I think we've shown a lack of respect, you know, for cultures outside of ourselves. And I think it probably will take groups outside of our government, because I think if there's going to be peace, we have to show that we respect cultures worldwide, not that just we're the big, powerful United States and we can do whatever we want.
I think that's a good point. Somebody said, you know, how can the United States take the international sympathy we had after September 11th? But everybody in the world was saying, boy, this is so terrible, and they love us and they care about us, and we're a beacon of hope, and turn it in a couple of years into one where we're the nation fighting a preemptive strike against a bad government, but a preemptive strike with very few allies, in a sense, and that many of them feeling pressured to do that. How we could do that, I think it is, as you say, largely the people have to do that, but it also is government can, instead of trying to do everything unilaterally, we can change the way we present ourselves to the world as a government as well as a country and people. One last one.
Well, what I was gonna say speaks to both of those issues also. And yesterday in the New York Times, one of our daughters brought it up, there is an article about how, in a sense, the State Department is losing ground rapidly in regard to these issues, because all the new embassies that we're building, the architecture is such that it makes it look like a fortress.
They're bomb-proof and, yeah, terrorist-proof.
And it's not a fortress, it's no longer downtown in the communities where people can walk by and look at a friendly face from the United States. It's out on an estate someplace in a suburb.
And you understand why they build them that way, but it also defeats the purpose of trying to, we're not going to be, I mean, if I was a U.S. government representative in the embassy somewhere, I think I'd want the fortress, but it also destroys your ability to function. But I hope this stimulates, the time is up, so I hope this stimulates some good discussion. I hope this is a good place to discuss these issues, and I welcome further comments and ideas, and hope you will distribute those brochures to people. So thank you very much for your attendance.